oh, 100 years ago or 300 years ago, if this was possible, they would have said it's impossible. What has allowed this to occur is the telephone. So now I can live as a Vishnusar Chassid in Atlanta, Georgia, the only Vishnusar Chassid in Atlanta, and whenever I have a question about what Vishnusar Chassidim do, what do? I call somebody, and I don't respect, validate, or interact with the local Rav. And we have communities that fundamentally interact with each other by weekly email. So you can have in any one neighborhood many, many, many different minhagim. The Aruch HaShulchan writes in one of his drashot that every single person in Novartik, Novartik is a pretty large town of which he was the chief rabbi. He's not writing, by the way, 1,000 years ago. He died in 1910. Adhered to his psakim, and he was the only Mora Hora in Novartik. Novartik, we think, had 5,000 families. He was the only authorized Mora Hora in the community, and he writes in one of his drashot that sometimes people didn't agree with his psakim, and he has no problem with that. They always had two choices. They could do it his way or leave. Okay, so they always had two choices. They could do it his way or leave, and that was simple. And lo and behold, he built a community of people who either adhered to his psakim or left. But in America, the question of what community do we look to is an exceedingly complicated question, because we see variated standards of tzniut located in the same geographical barrier, the same block, the same neighborhood, and everybody in the same neighborhood adheres to a different halachic community. And when you ask them who's their Mora Hora, they point to a Mora Hora who lives where? Far away. Far away. Not far away meaning a 20-minute run, or I can send my child there, but we're talking about a community that's far, far, far away, hundreds of miles, thousands of miles. So the hard question in America is, what do we mean when we talk about communal minhagim? Do we really have any notion at all of communal minhagim? That's a hard question. I confess to you I don't have an excellent answer. The more metropolitan the area becomes, the more it looks like Brooklyn, which is many, many, many different minhagim in a small geographical area with Jews on the same block belonging to different shuls and having very different customs and practices, meaning, you know, within a mile of the yeshiva of Flatbush, to pick, or Chaim Berlin, there are some 35 different distinct minhagim, from the far left of modern Orthodoxy to the far right of Satmar Chassidus, all physically in the same neighborhood, all gleefully not talking to each other in the same part of Brooklyn, all interacting as if they were their own separate kihilah. So one question is, when Halacha says, look to the minhag hatzniut, shenogu b'not Yisrael, the custom of modest people in the community, what community are we referring to? Rabbi Feinstein, by the way, thought that there was a different answer. It's never published in the Tshuvot, but he says it in Divrot Moshe, his commentary on the Talmud, and it's said over by his Talmidim. He thought the minimum standard was the standard adhered to by modest Gentiles, a group which has disappeared. Okay? Meaning, this has become more complicated because, you know, if I were to tell you, I'm a law professor at Emory University, and if I were to tell you that the standard of dress among students at Emory University is measured by the standard of dress adhered to by those men and women who don't engage in premarital sex, which is a pretty good measure of tzniut, I would say to you there's only three people we can look at, and all three of them are weird. Meaning, we don't live in a community where there's a large community of modest non-Jews. This makes life exceedingly complicated because, you know, my parents said these conversations didn't occur in the 50s. And when you asked your rabbi how to dress, the rabbi said, dress like all the other modest people on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. But there aren't any. Meaning what's happened is the modest center of America has disappeared, making it exceedingly complicated to figure out if Rabbi Feinstein is halachically right, and he has a proof text from a note of the Gra, he has a nice proof text that he's right, it might be absolutely completely halachically right, but utterly irrelevant, because we don't have a group to look at that allows us to see what modest non-Jews look like. It might, though, be exceedingly relevant in Iran. Okay? Meaning, by the way, Rabbi Feinstein's view is not always a leniency. One can conceptualize a society like Iran where I'm guessing, I don't know, but I'm guessing that there are lots of modest people because the government enforces modesty rules. One could say that Rabbi Feinstein's view is that you're obligated to dress like the modest people in the community dress. That might be stricter than the requirements otherwise found in halakha. Rabbi Feinstein's view of the minimum is that the Jews can't go around dressing any less modestly than the modest non-Jews, because if you go around dressing any less modestly than the modest non-Jews, you know what people say? The Jews are immodest. And there's a very strong proof text to this from a comment of the Gra. It makes a lot of sense that the Jews can't adhere to a lower standard than the modest non-Jews. So the first hard question is, what community do you look at? What community do you look at? And this affects what my wife jokingly calls heads, shoulders, knees, and toes. It affects all sorts of questions about line drawing, and a lot of it is a function of what community you look at. And you certainly see this if you walk around in Yerushalayim, where you see many, many, many different Orthodox communities adhering to many different modesty standards, each adamantly representing the fact that their community norm is normative, but they all stand together in the bus station as if they're one community, but then they go home and they daven in different shuls, but they walk around on the street together. So question number one is, what's the community that we're really talking about? This was not a question 100 years ago. This is more of a question nowadays. One answer is you look at the modest non-Jews. That answer might be right, but it might not be helpful. Another answer is you bear an obligation to identify with the community, and you identify with that community, and that community is the one you identify with. That's the view that Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach takes, which is everybody bears an obligation to join a kihila, a community, and adhere to the standards of that community. And the fact that there are other people who adhere to different standards doesn't matter one way or another. The standards that you adhere to are the standards that derive from the community that you are a member of, and that's that. The third answer is that there might be a citywide standard in some places, and citywide standards in some places mean that the community develops a norm, and you can't deviate from the norm, even if your little community does. Nonetheless, you bear an obligation to follow the whole. The argument here goes that on matters of eroticism, deviation from the norm is inherently erotic, and it doesn't matter if everybody in your small community deviates from the norm, since the vast community overwhelms you when you step outside deviating from the norm. What do people do? They stare, because they're seeing something they don't normally see, and that's erotic. Those are three answers. I don't know which answer is right. My inclination, logically, is that Rabbi Feinstein is right, but my inclination socially is that Rabbi Feinstein's right answer is unhelpful. We have to find a better answer than Rabbi Feinstein's analytically correct but socially not helpful answer. I mean, that's just the reality we live in. So I found, as a shul rabbi, it's not worthwhile to provide analytically correct but factually not helpful answers. You know, in law school, they always tell you that lawyers learn to provide technically accurate but completely worthless answers. They say the joke of the balloonist who points to the ground, points to somebody on the ground and says, "Where am I?" And the person on the ground says, "You're up there." Which in law school they always tell you is an example of a technically accurate but utterly completely meaningless answer. So it's of no use sometimes to provide people with theoretically correct but practically unhelpful answers. So that's issue number one, which is, what community does one adhere to? And there isn't any community left really in the United States that looks around and says, we have a single Mora Hora and we all adhere to the same standard. Maybe New Square. But I'm sure not even in Toronto. And I'm sure not in Atlanta. And I'm sure not in New York. And I've been to many Jewish cities, and I've yet to meet the chief rabbi of any city. And when I meet them, there's always another one. So I'm not sure that it's a successful way of thinking about community. The second conversation about tzniut is, how much does context drive this answer? Which is, it's one thing to talk about social norms. It's another thing to recognize that social norms sometimes are very nuanced, and they recognize not just that a particular conduct is modest or immodest, but sometimes the social norm recognizes that a particular activity is modest in one circumstance and immodest in another circumstance. And I think that that's of significant halachic validity. It's the foundational basis upon the minhag Yisrael, upon the common custom of women going to men doctors and men going to women doctors. The foundational argument goes, because of the professional level of interaction here, this conduct stops being erotic. What does that really mean in plain old English? That means context drives a certain amount of our definition of eroticism. Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, the writer of She'elotu Tshuvot B'nei Banim, argues that that assertion is incorrect. But in fact, I think it's socially very correct. We not only define eroticism by what we see, but we define eroticism very much by the context of where we see it. And that we understand that when we go to a doctor's office, or when we go visit a sick person in the hospital wearing a hospital gown, we see things that we otherwise wouldn't see, and that would otherwise be immodest to see, but the context causes us not to view this activity as erotic. And the reason why that's so is because eroticism is not just determined by a grand social norm, it's also somehow determined by what you see when you see it. And thus, certain elements of eroticism have not just a social component of place, has a social component of time. And thus, we are more liberal, for example, in our understandings of these matters in a healthcare context than we are in any other context, not because of pikuach nefesh, because we are blessed with a community loaded with both men and women doctors. This is not a situation where if we don't go to this doctor, we will die. These are social choices we make about who we want to see, who we want to treat us. And the recognition here produces a result that what's really going on is we don't think having an OBGYN exam by somebody who sits in the men's section of your shul is immodest so long as it's done in the context of a doctor's office, whereas if that exact same activity were done in the coat room of the shul, people would never, ever, ever stop talking. People would never, ever stop talking. So it's the context that drives this conversation rather than the activity itself. How exactly to parse the problem of location is very complicated. And it has to be categorized by the fact that our American society has completely flipped out. And what's happening in the secular society that we're in is more and more eroticism is going public. And it's not that that which is revealed anymore in public is not erotic because it's revealed in public. It's instead that the society that we're in has decided that eroticism in public is good. And that forces us to further withdraw. There is a difference between saying this body part is shown in public because it's not erotic, and saying this body part is shown in public because it is erotic, and we like public eroticism. That's definitely the way my law students behave. Public eroticism is a social norm among the non-observant under 25 crowd in an American university. I suspect it's true in a Canadian university as well. It's thankfully enough colder here. So being very cold makes these issues slightly less problematic. But there's a social norm here about eroticism, which doesn't have to do with the fact that these things are not erotic. It has to do with the fact that this eroticism is thought to be fun and interesting by college and law students. Makes it exceedingly difficult. I used to have a Rebbe in 11th grade who said the rule of thumb was anything you saw on a bus stop was not erotic. You know? But it's not true. It's not true. It probably was true in 1955, meaning in 1955 you could give a rule of thumb which says the way people dressed on a billboard in a bus stop was a suitable way for any religious woman to dress. But it hasn't. The test has completely lost any meaning because the society that we're in has decided it's entertaining and interesting to post erotic posters on bus stops. It makes it thus much more difficult to determine the role of place in helping to answer these questions. So the second hard question is the role of place. Maybe it was easier at a different time in a different place. Maybe I'm just gilding the past. But it's clear that we live in a much more complicated activity. The third is, as a prototype, I always use Rabbi Feinstein's example of shaking hands. When Rabbi Feinstein was asked about the context of men shaking women's hands, Rabbi Feinstein says, "I think it's prohibited." And the questioner says, "But I see many God-fearing rabbis who shake women's hands," and Rabbi Feinstein says, "They must rely on the fact that this activity is without any erotic intent, but I find that hard to believe." That's what he says. He says, "I find it hard to believe." The third issue is, he says, basically, what do you do with the fact that there's an intergenerational gap? Perceptions differ very much in the same society. The simple fact is that those who grew up in Europe, let's put ourselves in 1970 when Rabbi Feinstein is writing, the European generation grew up with it unacceptable for men and women to shake hands. And they grew up this way because they grew up this way. And when they came to America, this activity still struck them as erotic. And thus they prohibited it. I suspect that the younger American generation, whom Rabbi Feinstein is referring to, grew up in a society where men and women shake hands. It's well nigh impossible to be involved in commerce in the United States, or even the United States and Canada, without shaking hands of everybody. And you can't succeed in business because in our society, it's not an erotic gesture, it's a social gesture. Why this is so, I don't know. But there was a recognition that there was a period of time where this activity was subject to some intergenerational disagreement. Not only does place make a difference and time make a difference, but it turns out where you were trained and how you grew up makes a difference. And that it's very hard to give exactly concrete answers to this question. Rabbi Feinstein discusses, the tshuva I didn't reproduce, the problem of the A train. I don't know how many of you have been in New York. So the A train is the subway line that takes you to Washington Heights. It goes all the way from Far Rockaway through Queens, Brooklyn, up through Manhattan. It ends up in the Bronx. It only doesn't touch Staten Island. And in 1950-something, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who was the Rosh Yeshiva Montreau and the writer of the Sri Deyesh, was visiting YU, and he came up to YU on the subway train, and as was the style, the subway train was packed, and when he came to YU, he remarked to people that it was usher to ride the A train because the men and the women were squished together. If you've ever been on an A train in rush hour, the men and women are squished together, and you can't help but be pressed against the person who's next to you, and gender selection is just not allowed. Meaning you don't have the ability to decide who you're going to be squished against. And Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg said it was intuitively usher to be in that situation where you randomly get pressed against whomever got on the subway train before you. He was a European civilized Jew. And Rabbi Feinstein writes the tshuva dealing with riding on the subway in response to this. And he says, in essence, you live here. You know what happens? You get used to it. It might not be great, he says, but this is the reality of the life we live in. People don't suffer erotic thoughts on the A train because they understand that this is just the life they're living in, and they go on the A train, they stay until they're stopped, and then they get off. And they don't even pay any attention to who they're squished against. This is just the unpleasant life of New Yorkers. And Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg is wrong, he says, not because he's intrinsically wrong, but because there's an element of habituation and norm. So it's very hard to know answers to these questions. I find teaching the theory of tzniut is very, very, very valuable. I find applying it in a reality is exceedingly complicated because it's governed by a set of social norms that I'm not sure I understand. And even when I think I understand them for myself, I'm not sure I understand them for the people who are 30 years older than me or 30 years younger than me. And I'm not sure I understand them outside of my narrow social framework or the place that I live in. So you deal with an exceedingly complicated set of variables, but the theory is extremely important to teach because we occasionally encounter grand statements of theories of tzniut, of modesty, that miss all the theoretical. And they instead talk to you about what you're supposed to do without any notion of the fact that what you're supposed to do could change from time to time or place to place or have a subjective component to it. So I don't very much want to answer here a set of questions about tzniut in Toronto for many, many, many different reasons, or even in Atlanta, Georgia, where I know something about what's going on. But I intended to teach here a theoretical construct for thinking about a set of problems in a way that I think very much reflects the halachic sources, but yet are not commonly presented this way and are instead frequently presented as just a set of black and white immutable rules with no social context at all. So if you come out of this with an intellectual foundation, I've accomplished my goal. I don't intend here to change anybody's standard one way or another, but to try to provide a foundation to explain what you see and why you see it and how it sometimes changes. Have a good day.
Is a swimming pool equal to a bathhouse?
I don't really have any idea socially. Swimming pools have a social connotation that makes them hard to define. I don't know. It might be a difference between a person who's swimming laps or a person who's going to an exercise class in a pool than a group of 16-year-olds. So it's very hard to know the answers to these questions. They have a social component. Of swimming, I think, in the United States is mostly a recreational activity. Recreation is a little bit scary.
I think your view of how Gentile women dress is distorted by your environment, because certainly in the work environment, women wear dresses, skirts. They're a lawyer or whatever. They dress like normal. They dress like normal people. I don't know what's like it at Emory, but I don't think it's the same here. There are Gentile women who dress modestly, I think, who could serve as a standard.
Okay, I can't answer that question one way or another. My wife sometimes tells me that a good measure of tzniut is how women dress. My wife is an attorney for the U.S. Department of Labor, and she commonly remarks that a measure of tzniut is how women dress going to court. Could be. It's certainly not how law students dress going to my class. I don't know what to say. It could be that the women in Toronto are more modest.
I just have a very technical question for Rabbi Breuder. I was puzzled by the translation of Asur Lishamesh B'Isha Klal. I would have thought that Mishamesh means to serve, and that it seemed to me from context that the Sol Seif in the Shulchan Aruch was talking about having a female servant, a waitress, a maid, a bathhouse attendant, and so on, rather than talking about general social interactions. I can see how some of the things in the Ramah might be talking about social interactions, but it seemed to me that the Shulchan Aruch was really talking about service. And there was, could be perhaps making a distinction between the fact that in, say, rabbinic times, one would not have waitresses or female servants attending men, whereas in medieval times it was quite common.
I don't think that the Shulchan Aruch in the siman is dealing with what you would call waitressing services. It's generally the siman that deals with all interactions between men and women other than a husband and a wife. So all that I can tell you is, if you've derived that impression, it's because I haven't given you enough of the text to derive a contrary impression. All of this comes from Chaf Aleph, which is the general siman in the Shulchan Aruch that deals with all of these interactions. It was a failure on my part to cut and to paste enough, and instead I've cut too much. But it's just a question of how much text I want to teach.
My question is for Mrs. Rutner. I used to teach in yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael in the Mevaseret Zion, and when the issue of women halachic advisors came up, there was a lot of concern among the rabbis there that in fact that, you know, half of the staff, it was a very interesting discussion, half of the staff felt this was wonderful because for women who were not comfortable talking, this provided another outlet and, as you mentioned, some very valuable advice in cases, specific cases. Yet others felt that this would infringe upon the role of the rabbi, and they felt this very threatened. I'm just very curious to know what your experience has been with the rabbis in your community, because you are now taking a role post-sicket, essentially. Again, I'm using a loaded word, but that is a role that you are now taking that I'm wondering how the rabbis in your community have responded and what sort of experiences you've had on a personal level.
Well, my title is not a post-sicket, it's a yo-esset. And one of the things I do, which I'll be actually talking about in the next session, is that I play a role as a facilitator. You know, when I first came to my position, I had a friend who actually said to me, well, why are you needed here? What's your purpose? Of course, she felt comfortable going to a rabbi, but there are many women who don't. But I'm not here to take the place of a rabbi. I work in conjunction with rabbis, and I can't tell how many women I've actually taken with me to rabbis to ask their question, or encouraged women to go to rabbis themselves and told them what to ask and what to say so they would get the proper answer for themselves. But I'm in no way here, and I haven't had any negative reaction because, again, I'm not trying to take over anyone's role. I'm just trying to help elevate the halachic observance of women in the area of Taharat HaMishpacha and to, in fact, enhance their relationship with rabbis. And I think that I've succeeded in doing that to some extent.
Rabbi Brody, I was fascinated by the concept that we have a non-Jewish standard of which we compare ourselves to decide what's appropriate, like to look at some nice, modest Christian women. And of course, if more Muslims come in, then we may have to go the burqa, because that may become a standard. So I always sort of think that since the Torah is like a light unto nations, how do we draw upon other standards to become our standard?
So famously enough, there's a tshuva of the Rambam dealing with whether women have to cover their face in a society where women cover their face. The Rambam is inclined to say no. But essentially, one of the themes of the shir of this class is that tzniut standards revolve around that which is socially obvious. Revealing that which otherwise isn't normally seen is erotic. And that this is somewhat intuitive. To me, this is somewhat intuitive. That eroticism has a component of revealing that which is not commonly seen. And thus it has a social component to it. And in a society in which the non-Jews are profoundly modest, of course it impacts on the standards adhered by modest people throughout, because if you are revealing that which is in your society not revealed, people stop and stare. And that act of stopping and staring is erotic. Let's take what in America at least is a bizarre example, but which was common in Muslim countries, women nursing in public. It was common in Muslim countries, the poskim note, that women nursed in public, so much so that the Ben Ish Chai says that women nursed in the shul in the women's section, and they didn't stop davening for it. In my shul, I would stop davening if a woman were nursing in the women's section, not covered. Whereas the Ben Ish Chai takes the view that the uncovered breast of a woman while nursing is not immodest, because in the society that he is in, this was normal. So this is both a stricture and a leniency. The simple fact is that eroticism entails seeing that which isn't normally seen. And you can't get away from the fact that men find... men don't draw the difference between Jewish women and not Jewish women, and neither do women. And thus the definition of eroticism is found in what men see in women, not necessarily in Jewish women, at least in an integrated society like we are in.
But the natural extension of that is if burqas become more commonplace here, the women would have to adopt burqas. I mean, that's almost
okay.
Like the natural...
It might be faces are different than everything else, but the question of what a woman has to cover or uncover is dependent by what other modest women cover or uncover in the street. I think that could be right. If one lives in such a society and one doesn't like that, one moves to a different society rather than walks around in the street revealing that which modest people don't reveal. I think that's the answer.
I kind of feel like an Israeli representative here. First of all, you wanted to, Mrs. Rutner, you want to be in contact with Rav Geshler in Open Up Ofra, because my daughter in Yudav, grade 11 drives me crazy with all her questions because she's learning. So there are people in Israel who are already working, so you might be able to short-circuit your curriculum development by getting in touch with them. The other thing I want to take issue with you, and that is that I'm experiencing North America through an Israeli's eyes, although I was really born here, but that's another story because it was so many years ago that I don't remember. What I want to say to you, though, is when you were describing New York, I was thinking Yerushalayim. And although you alluded to it, I feel that the real issue is, like you said, what was the posek? You have to connect to a kehila. Right, that's doctrine. Because I think the real issue is aser harav. And in Israel, people are comfortable with that. I go to a minyan in the Kotel HaMaravi that have three or four edot, okay, and we all agree on nusach hachid for the purpose of the minyan. And we all go home, and one eats kitniot, and one doesn't, and one eats matzah soya, and the other doesn't. And there's no tension there. There's a mutual respect. Although, albeit, the issues of tzniut are more complicated.
I believe, though, that the issues of tzniut are different than the issues of kitniot, precisely because the nature of eroticism is more complicated. You cannot tell people that because this woman is in a kiilah, where this conduct is viewed as proper, you shouldn't view the way she dresses as erotic. Because these are not fully logical constructs. There's a greater press for common standards in one location, in tzniut, than there is in food, precisely because food is a more controllable activity than these kinds of activities. So it's not that I disagree with you in theory, but like other things I've said, this might be only a theoretically useful answer, but not, in fact, a practically useful answer. And I try very hard to avoid providing answers that are only in theory valuable.
And to Mrs. Lubin, then when we all live in a society that the Torah is our aspired norm, then we won't have to worry about both of them.
Rabbi Broidy, would the halachas with respect to women covering their hair follow the same principles?
No. I suppose I should say a little bit more about that, but I don't want to here. The answer is that hair covering has both leniencies and strictures. Fundamentally, hair is no longer thought to be erotic in our society, and thus the foundation for hair covering follows a different analytic path. And I am of the view, as Rabbi Feinstein says, that hair covering has no foundational basis in erva, has its foundational basis in some other set of prohibitions that are not addressed in this shir. That's why hair is unique, because Ben Ashkenaz draws the distinction between married and unmarried, a distinction that we don't draw, for example, with regards to knees or belly buttons or any other body part. So I've consciously stayed away from hair. It's a topic that those of you who know me know I occasionally write about it. But it fundamentally draws its origins from a different set of Talmudic verses that might or might not be a Torah obligation, but is of a totally different analytic construct than all of the other rules of Hilchot Tzniut, because we don't view hair in our society as erotic.
Thank you both again. Thank you all for your attention. The next session will start at 3:30.
Isn't it 3:30 now? It should be 3:25 now.